start with our final topic, which is the presentation by our Canadian friends on hybrid pension schemes.
Yes.
And the accounting for it.
Yes. So I want to emphasize at the beginning that our staff has compiled the information and you saw it in the data sheet, you saw it in your slides, but that the work has been done by a group of pension setters, ourselves, Germany, Japan, the UK, and the US. So this is a collective effort in terms of a topic of mutual interest. And so what we're going to do is have a brief setup of the discussion. We're going to take the slides as largely read. I have a few opening comments, and then again, I'll turn it over to Rebecca. If you look at slide two, you know, why the research and now, just from an experience perspective, certainly from a Canadian perspective, when we look back at the period from 1990 to 2016, we're seeing huge proliferation, almost 300%, of disappearing peer DB plans and a variety of plans coming into play, and that has accelerated in the recent few years, where even if DB plans continue to exist, they're closed to new entrants and they're in wind-down mode, which of course will take a fair amount of time. So the landscape of which we're dealing has changed significantly. The same is true in the U.S. In terms of some of the changes where they're seeing the rise in cash balance plans, et cetera. And it's true, I think, to a greater or lesser extent in the other jurisdictions. And I'll let the representatives from those jurisdictions speak to that. We did present an earlier version of this paper to IFAS. And in September 2017, we heard from other jurisdictions, notably Austria, Mexico, France, India, Italy, and Korea, that they had similar plans, and so we're awaiting data from them. Our concern is that the accounting issues arise because they don't fit into the traditional guidance with regard to the pension accounting model that our team works to. And more interestingly, some of our discussions have been around the work that the actuaries do conveniently to fill in the gap so that we can get accounting outcomes, but the work that those actuaries do may be very different in different jurisdictions. Hence, that multiplies the notion of diversity in practice. And so we think that that it's important. You heard this morning that a number of people raised the issue of the disclosure review. We're really more focused on the actual accounting. I'm not saying that the disclosure isn't an issue, but that we're focused on the accounting. The other thing that is happening, particularly in Canada, is that these plans are proliferating in the public sector, and they're getting a lot of press in Canada, and that's pushing it back into our domain as the standard setter in Canada around what can be done on the private sector side as we start identifying these things. So it ends up being quite a hot topic with regard to the level of discussions and the frequency of discussions in our particular jurisdiction. So with that, I'm going to flip it over to Rebecca. She's going to give you kind of the way we went about doing the research, et cetera, taking a few highlights so that we can get the conversation started. Rebecca?
Thank you, Linda. So just to touch on, firstly, I'll cover our research design, our findings, and then really what our ask is as part of this discussion, and we'll then ask the other members who helped to collaborate on this research to give some final comments, and then turn it over to you to get your feedback on this research. So looking at the kind of overall research design, what we did do was start off by doing an environmental scan. So we actually worked to understand the evolution of what was happening in the pension space by going to statistics to see the decline of the number of defined benefit plans, to then kind of understand why that was happening. And it really comes from a business perspective that really entities are looking to mitigate or reduce their exposure to these pension obligations. So similar to what we were hearing from a FICE or liability equity perspective, is they're finding these new innovative ways to do that. So when you look to an older standard like IS 19 and those in our local gap that we were also assessing, the question now is that standard fit for purpose? And in essence, with these new innovative ways, is this IS 19 resulting in both the kind of the economic characteristics of these pension obligations being reported? with understanding that, we then actually took a bottom-up approach to actually consult and did a survey to see what kinds of plans were out there and to get the actual characteristics and what accounting challenges they were facing, both applying IFRSs and our local standards. That involved actually getting input from over kind of 25 audit firms and, of course, pension benefit firms as part of building up that base. We did face some challenges when it came to terminology across our different jurisdictions and given the vast number of plans. So from that analysis, we found it was really best to identify four more common plans, to then do further outreach to each of the jurisdictions to say, do you see these in your jurisdiction? How would you account for them from a classification side and then from getting feedback on a measurement side? Overall, what we found is that the plans do exist in multiple jurisdictions. We're seeing diversity in classification and as well difficulties in how you actually do the measurement guidance. So what I wanted to kind of reflect on is that on slide 5, we've identified the four common types of plans that we looked at. Turning to slide 7, this is really where we look to say, okay, when you look at the plans are found, how prevalent are they? We're seeing a growing interest in shared risk plans, but all of the other three types of plans we're seeing in more than one jurisdiction. And particularly, the security-linked type plans exist in all four jurisdictions. The only one they don't yet is in Japan. And from a cash balance, we're seeing it in U.S., Germany, and Japan. Shared risk seems to be evolving in North America. Slide 8 is where we recapped the classification challenges. And this is where I'm of concern is the security-linked plan. We can see being accounted for, classified, I should say, as 3 or 4 different ways. So it could be a defined contribution, so DC with a DB guarantee. It could be a defined benefit only. It could be then a defined contribution or defined benefit following the draft IFRIC interpretation. So what's concerning is the different, a similar plan is getting classified and then accounted for in different ways. What we did find with the others is that they were defaulting following the IS-19 approach to a defined benefit classification. Slide 9 touches on some of the measurement challenges that we're facing. And when you look to shared risk plans, where it is equal weighting when there is an underfunded, the question or the challenge comes is how do you know when that's triggered and then what the employer portions could be? Of course, what assumptions do you use relating to understanding those future benefits as well? From the security, the other shared risk plan, we saw that actually its benefits are based on a tiering on a set formula. So if it becomes less underfunded, it affects the benefits that are paid out to current members. So the question is, how do you predict that? From turning to kind of the security link plan, similar to the research our EFRAG colleagues are doing, when you do have, the returns linked to the specified assets, what should that discount rate be? Were some of the questions we heard back. So not only did we look to see what were these difficulties, we also looked to say, okay, what could be some of those potential solutions? We sought and explored multiple ideas, and this is where, I guess importantly, as a first stop, we looked to the past work the ISB had done. We did see some overlap, but none of the options that we were exploring had been rejected, so still ways to possibly address these issues. We then had a fruitful discussion with our IFAS colleagues last September to try to weigh the viability of some of these proposals. And what that helped us really to narrow what the option would be. But unfortunately, there isn't one clear winner or solution. The view seemed to be that you probably would have to take, use several of those options to try to be responsive to the different challenges we saw given the different types of plans. There seemed to be a view that if we could get more principle-based guidance that involved the use of judgment, that could very much help in this approach. Within the paper, we really are, I think, narrowing it down to, would encourage the consideration kind of unbundling of the DC and DB components. looking to what we've called kind of a specific measurement methodology with also a focus on guarantees. And then, again, just to reiterate, being able to link in with the work that our EFRAG is doing from for Security Link's perspective. So really, our proposal that we're bringing forward today is that really based on the research we've done today, that we're going to continue to supplement it from some further input we've received from IFAS colleagues, in particular Norway, Korea, and Israel, that with this, and as well considering user and academic research from each of the five jurisdictions, that we feel we've brought forward kind of the evidence to say when within our jurisdictions, there's a need for additional guidance. Given the diversity that's arising and how it's being, the current guidance is being interpreted. So as Linda referred to earlier, when they're doing these interpretations, this often is getting factored into the actuarial calculations that are being done. So importantly, the risk, I think, from our standard setting perspective, is that we've got pension obligations that could be being reported today that might not actually reflect those obligations. And when you come to times of economic challenge and companies are stretched, what that could mean and unfold. So from this perspective, we're raising this, and our ask is the ISB is to really consider this research as part of, should we say, taking on work to really provide guidance for hybrid pension plans. So with that, I'd like to kind of turn to our fellow partners in crime and in carrying out this research to ask any further points that they would like to elaborate on.
I could give it a start. Probably the number one issue that became quite apparent for me is one size doesn't fit all. And the problem is that, as Rebecca has rightly said, the standard is quite outdated. It's based on an American model, I'd say, with FAS 87. Yes, the standard has been amended, but the basic concept, the binary concept of you are either DB or DC, you can't be both, you can't be anything in between, I think has been retained. And you make the link to the FICE project, and I think there we have said pure equity, pure debt, yes, they do exist, but the magnitude of mezzanine in between is just growing. And the same, I think, goes for pension plans as well. So, I mean, our jurisdiction certainly was one that has been accused significantly by rating agencies probably a decade ago or 15 years ago for unfunded or underfunded defined benefit plans, and a lot has happened there. But what we have seen is that pure DB plans have really been closed to new entrants, and everything that we now see is really risk sharing. And risk sharing really doesn't fit the IAS 19 model per se. So the question is, what can you do? And I think what we have explored and what we've discussed with IFAS participants is you can take one of two routes. One would be to address all the problems in a patchwork situation where you say you do targeted measures that would probably help one, maybe two of the plans, but not serve the other ones. So you have to employ quite a lot of changes, and the risk is there that you really become rules-based and provide for a solution that doesn't really tie back to the core principle, or you really start from scratch, which from first sight doesn't seem very appealing. But on the other hand, we were, I think, quite in agreement that if there wasn't any standard on pension accounting and you were to write a pension standard anew or fresh, we believe that it would look quite different today. You probably would be coming from a perspective more in line with, say, IFRS 17. You account for the obligation that you really take on board. You wouldn't be overly prescriptive as to how you do the measurement, but rather say, okay, what is that measurement or to portray, things like that. And we believe that might be a long-term solution or longer-term solution rather than going down that patchwork route. So that's probably what I would just add to what Rebecca and Linda said.
The data that was collected for the U.S. indicated about 13% of Fortune 500 companies had hybrid plans. And there is some limited guidance in U.S. GAAP for cash balance plans that have a fixed crediting rate. And also for floor offset plans, it's quite limited to about two paragraphs, I think, in total of all of the guidance. There is no guidance for cash balance plans with variable crediting rates. The board did, prior to my joining the board, I think it was just around the time that Jim joined the board, actually, a while ago, the board did consider a very narrow scope project to provide some additional guidance related to cash balance plans with variable crediting rates or variable rates, but ultimately decided not to pursue that project because of difficulty in scoping and the concern that it was going to lead to opening up the entire model, which, again, based on the data, while it's 13% of these hybrid plans, about 80% of plans are in the category of defined contribution plans in the U.S., so I think that the board was a little hesitant to open up the entire model at that point. We did have pensions as one of the options in the invitation to comment that we recently did. I think I was the only board member that voted for taking that project on, at least in some form or fashion. So the decision was made not to pursue that at this time, not because it was felt that the guidance was perfect and not in need of improvement, but just because there were other topics, liabilities and equity performance reporting, that were exposed as part of the invitation to comment, and it was decided that those should take precedence. We did, however, recently in our disclosure review on pensions add a requirement as one of the assumptions that needs to be disclosed, the weighted average interest crediting rate, because that is something that users were asking for to help understand some of the assumptions that underlie corporate estimates with respect to those plans. So I guess in summary, I'd just say that, we appreciate the opportunity to participate in this data gathering exercise, and I think that it did illustrate and bring to the table a lot of really important data that illustrates where there are some areas for potential improvements and diversity in practice that should get addressed at some point, and we will be watching whatever you all choose to do and learning from it to make your decisions.
Yes. From Japan, pensions are highly regulated, and therefore there's not much choice between a traditional DB plan and a traditional DC plan. But we are hearing from our preparers in our jurisdictions that when they operate overseas, they do see these new plans coming, and therefore we're happy to participate in the discussions, but within our jurisdiction, we don't have much debate as to the plans because it's so regulated.
So it's not quite clear to me how these hybrid plans are being accounted for right now, what currently diversions in practice, but do they depart from defined benefit? Do they take defined benefit accounting as the
space
departure point, and then adjust it or don't adjust it?
That's the black box.
Yeah.
And that's where the actuaries come in.
Yeah. They,
so if the
actuaries make the adjustments.
So if I
that's what they're going to do with IFRS 17.
You know where that ends, you know.
Very careful measurement of
Let me describe that with simple and with my words. The standard currently treats DC plans as an exception to the pension accounting. It says only if the employer doesn't retain any risk, it can be accounted for as a defined contribution plan, and all the others are just defined benefit plans. In countries like mine, this has created an issue because there is no way that an employer could rid of any risk, because there is a law that says you do have you do undertake supplementary solvency risk should you defer that pension obligation to an insurer and that insurer goes bust, it all comes back to you. And you can't get rid of that. It's just written in our law. So by definition, you would say, we do not have defined contribution plans. That, by the way, is at odds, I'd say, with guidance that exists elsewhere in IFRSs. If you just think about your materiality practice statement that says, if there's only a remote chance that something could happen, you just ignore that piece. Well, in pension accounting, you do not ignore that piece. You just say, if there is a remote chance, sorry, you're out. So that means you're kicked into DB plan accounting, which means you account for the plan as if the employer had retained 100% of the risk, where clearly it has not. Then the question is, okay, how can that be mitigated? Because if it really led to 100% accounting for the risk, the pension liability would be highly overstated. And then that is where the actuaries come in and say, okay, we take care of it, and we provide you with a number where we believe the thing should go, really. And this is not to say that they're tweaking the standard, but they work by their standards and bring what really the outcome should be.
Yeah.
But that, to me, as an accounting standard setter, has a bitter taste, because I'd rather take care of my issues myself rather than let others do my job.
Is what they do in the Netherlands as well, do you know?
It's done on a worldwide basis, as we understand. Because the actuaries work in networks, they have large firms as well, and they work by global standards. So it's not really that that each of the actuaries decide for themselves how can I, quote-unquote, tweak the standard. It's really that they have models that work on a global basis. But the interesting thing that we so far weren't able to gauge from the market is, how do users see this? Do they actually know what's going on in the process? So if you start with the standards, that standard actually leads you to overstating pension liabilities, and you don't know that actually somebody in the process has taken care of that. How does the market actually react? Do they take a discount? Do they just leave the numbers as they are? We have no idea. And that's something where we certainly want to do further research.
Andrew?
Thanks. Well, thank you very much for the research and for bringing it to the ASEF. You mentioned, Rebecca, that AFRAC has a research project with a somewhat narrower focus. And I think our respective teams are exchanging information well on that, so we appreciate the collaboration. Yeah, the AFRAC focus is on the plans with a promise linked to asset returns, security-linked plans, as they're described here. I don't think there's any sort of magic in determining that scope. It's just been a process. We have a pensions advisory panel, a group of experts who've been discussing, I guess, so three questions. So what are the new types of plans that are becoming widespread, in this case in Europe? To what extent can we say that applying IAS 19 to these categories, or which of those categories are there specific issues with IAS 19? And in this case, it's primarily the fact that if there's an asset-based, asset-linked return, then the benefit projection is based on the asset return, and the discount rate is based on a high-quality corporate bond or a government borrowing rate in the absence of a deep and liquid market for the former. Then what solutions can we think up? And it's a sort of, to what extent, like some tunnelling exercise from both ends. Is there enough meeting up in the middle between the potential solutions and the problematic plans to judge that it's worth coming up with a new way of accounting for these plans that would actually solve more problems than it creates? And it would create some problems, because we're going from having a single cliff effect in IAS 19 between DB and DC to having two cliff effects between DC, third category, and DB, one boundary to two boundaries. We're doing research activities like you, so it's very premature to start thinking about, well, what could the outcome be, but nonetheless, I guess what we are contemplating with the direction of our research is potentially a third way, and I'd be interested to hear from Peter or the ISB on whether that's sort of similar to the contemplation of the feasibility study underway here. But looking at your work, so if I get the impression that maybe you'd contemplate a third accounting model, but maybe more contemplating replacing IS-90 in its entirety. So I'd be interested in any reflections on that.
Peter.
Okay.
Hospital pass.
Let me give you a few thoughts, and I'll declare an interest as the project manager when IS-19 was written in the late 90s. And also I was involved in the revision in 2011 as well.
It's the 1890s.
So the first point is any project on this is not going to be a quick one. That is absolutely clear, because all the issues are interconnected, and when you touch one piece, something else will move somewhere else. Another point maybe is on this whole thing about pure DC, pure DB, the way the definitions are set up in IS-19, to be honest, nobody needs an accounting standard to tell them how to account for a real defined contribution plan with no risk to the employer. It's absolutely obvious how you account for it. And in fact, our first draft of IS-19 didn't make the distinction at all. We just said the DC sort of falls out as the limiting case at the end, but then people said that's too difficult because you have to read a very long, complex standard to discover that you don't have a problem. So the DC was sort of set up as a simplification where it doesn't make any difference. On this point about risk-sharing, I mean, one of the objectives of the revision in 2011 was to deal with some of the risk-sharing, and to some extent we achieved that. The Netherlands, for example, was one of the countries that was very interested in what was going on at the time. I think it helped a bit. It obviously doesn't seem to have solved all of the issues. There is a kind of principle in IS-19. It's sort of probably a bit buried in the detail, but the principle is that you're trying to account for the estimated ultimate cost of providing the benefit that's been earned to date. The difficult part of it is the earned to date, particularly if you decide you're not going to restrict yourself just to vested benefits, because then really anything you do for the non-vested portion to some extent is arbitrary and needs to be based on a rule. But I suspect people aren't going to want to go to excluding all unvested benefits, because you get extreme cases. For example, there were schemes in France, I don't know if they still exist, but there were schemes where if you retired at 64 and 364 days, you got no pension, and if you retired at 65, you got the full pension. And waiting until the last day of your 65th year didn't really seem like a good way of accounting for the pension costs for those. So I think some sort of accounting for the unvested benefits is almost inevitable. Just another anecdote while we're about this. In 2010, we had a discussion with the actuaries who persuaded us that we could reduce some of the diversity in the discount rate, because at the moment, the way the discount rate requirements are written, they're sort of a mix of two objectives, sometimes high-quality corporate bonds, sometimes bonds. And they said, wouldn't it be a good idea if we had a single objective? And they said this is going to be simple and uncontroversial. And the board was so persuaded that we put out an ED with a 30-day comment period. And needless to say, it wasn't simple or uncontroversial. So we didn't pursue that. The project in the research pipeline is very, very targeted, and that was deliberate after the last agenda consultation. The board obviously looked at a whole range of different priorities in the last agenda consultation, decided there wasn't sufficient demand for a broad-scope pension project at that stage, and so decided not to take on a broad-scope project over this agenda cycle. Of course, for the next agenda cycle, everything's up for grabs again, but over this agenda cycle, the board thought it wasn't a high enough priority to do. But thought that there was this one targeted piece we could do which gets to a known anomaly, which clearly gives the wrong answer. And it's not designed to solve all the problems, but this is a kind of self-inflicted wound which we think we can deal with a surgical strike. One of the attractions of the approach we're going for is that it wouldn't need to be scoped. And that's one of the big problems with D9 and the follow-up work was scoping. This one would be kind of self-scoping, which is very attractive because it means we don't have to go through all the scope discussions, if we're correct about how it works, which is the piece we did explore in the research. So personally, I'd love to look at pensions again. I think there are things we could do to improve it. but it won't be quick or easy, and I think if the board wants to take it on, it'll have to knock something else off the agenda, probably, to make space for it.
But do I understand that with these adjustments that the actuaries made, that there is not a vast overstatement of the liability now on the balance
sheet? That's what we hear.
Because otherwise...
I'm not an actuary, so I can't prove it, but I would just rely on what the experts say, and I just say this seems to be a fair reflection.
I think, by the way, Andres, you slightly sort of oversold the case when you said that IAS 19 makes you account for 100% of the risk. I don't think that's actually true, because I think you do take account of the risk, of the risk sharing, but it's not done in a very sophisticated way. The whole model's set up on a best estimate basis, so you make a single point estimate of the outcome, and then trying to build the risk sharing into that is not a very flexible tool for dealing with it.
Yeah. So... That's why I deliberately said I use my own simple words, but you're right, I probably overshot them that way.
Andreas? Question from your own experience here. I know that it's hard to be simplistic about actuarial terms, stuff, but pretty much what you've got on a defined benefit is you have a certain, you're sure about the liability, you're not certain about the amount you're going to pay, but you're sure that you have that liability. And this hybrid plans, generically speaking, there are some probabilities involved if you have gonna end up having a liability or not, or 10% liability.
Yes.
At the end of the day, there's gonna be an actuarial calculation of the amount of that liability. It's my point is do they, assuming the actuaries are doing their job properly, which is something that I don't think we're going to be able to just access now or not even later. It should the amount of the liability, as Hans mentioned, be understated or overstated?
I think there's two issues in 19 as I see it. There's two objectives. One is to get the liability right, and the actuaries are probably taking care of that part. The other bit is the allocation over time, period to period. And that's the bit probably that actuaries are less...
And I think it's that allocation over time that's actually the most difficult part.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Mary?
Or my alter ego, Francois.
Small transformation.
Finally teach me French. Andreas, just thinking back to the... perhaps I detect some concern in what you're saying about the lack of transparency about what people are doing, and it certainly strikes me. And I know I've heard over the years that in Germany, in particular, maybe more broadly in continental Europe, some people are looking to deny that draft IFRIC interpretation as kind of the framework for addressing the accounting that doesn't seem to sit, and they're doing it on the basis that if it was published as an interpretation of existing 19, it is at least a valid, if not, because it was not finalized, not required. But I guess, ever positive and hopeful, I would expect somebody to be giving maybe an accounting policy and other disclosures about how they are addressing this issue if it is something that doesn't fit neatly within IAS 19 and how they have developed their accounting policy. And I guess one question is whether, maybe almost harking back to our PP&E discussion this morning, whether making the point about expectation for disclosures about significant judgments and the judgment about how you account for the plan is one route that might get some more transparency around what companies are doing. And I'm not talking about publishing actuarial tables as part of that, but a description of the approach and how they are factoring in what may be a secondary, risk assumption in the measurement of their liabilities is something I would expect to see.
The interesting bit is I could foresee that if you mandated that disclosure, what you would get is a highly likely boilerplate, and the reason for that is that most companies, and even the very largest ones, don't do the calculations themselves. To just outsource that completely to the actuary function, and then they just get a sort of resume and they take whatever is in there. So that's why in, when you read the accounting policies disclosure note, you just refer to what's in the standard. You use the POCM and you list the tables of the factors, the interest rate, pension age, and things like that, but not really the thought process that has gone into the actuarial thinking, because that relies with the actuarial function.
But I think, you know, I think we're starting to hear more and more these days, well, if you impose that disclosure requirement, you're just going to get boilerplate, and it's thrown at us a lot as, you know, it almost feels like trying to scare us off disclosure requirements. And I think we have to be able to go back and say, is this actually communicating useful information to users of financial statements? And if you're in this unclear area, it's directors taking responsibility for the, you know, the financial statements and not just saying, I'm stapling in what I got. I mean, this is all very idealistic and easy at this table, but I think talking about this expectation. Yeah.
I hear you, and that's, I think, the bit of research that certainly we have to be doing, which is what are users actually taking from the financial statements? What piece of information are they actually using? Because we have also heard that users, by and large, seem to be quite confident with the amount of disclosures that IAS 19 provides.
But are they even aware that... are they even aware that, they're looking at financial statements that have this question mark in them?
Yes. I don't know. My suspicion is no, they don't. But that's a suspicion.
Sue?
I was going to ask the same question and make the same comment as Mary.
Maybe not as idealistically.
Mary's. Maybe not as politely. But, and I guess, just to add to what Mary said, I don't think, well, it might be difficult because an actuary's done it for you. It's their financial statements. So surely they have an obligation to explain the process that's been gone through and enough assumptions that somebody reading the financial statements doesn't just think, well, it's a black box, therefore I've just got to take it at face value. So it would seem to me that improving disclosures surely has got to be better than nothing.
Linda?
So just a couple of points that I wanted to make. In terms of the actuarial side of it, I'm not as confident as you may be, Andreas, that there are global practices. So, for instance, on a topic near and dear to your heart, IFRS 17, we got a presentation at my oversight council from the actuarial folks around how they were approaching 17, what they were doing to get prepared, and how they were linking into the international activities. It's made very clear to us that while there's an activity at the International Actuarial Board, it's up to the Canadian actuaries to decide to adopt that or not. There's not an automatic mechanism that says we'll completely adopt what's being recommended internationally. So the practice in Canada has been traditionally to do that, but there's no automatic mechanism, and I don't know what the practices are elsewhere. So number one, I'm not completely confident that the actuarial approach in Germany would be the same as the actuarial approach to something in Canada and vice versa. So that's just one comment that I'll make. Because that actually has a lot to do with not only just the pension standard, but any time you need to deal with actuaries. Secondly, from a timing perspective, you just have to remember where we've come from. So call it 10 or 12 years ago, I was in industry dealing with a big S pension plan, and we had a big actuarial liability, you know, and some of it had to do with kind of the size of the plan, the inherent interest rates at the time, et cetera. But I can remember poring over the actuarial stuff, and what you were trying to find was a quarter of a point justification for changing the discount rate because of the impact it was going to have in terms of where you'd land. Now, we're not there anymore. So you've gone from having these big numbers that were liabilities. Then we went through the phase where they started flipping. You got some surpluses, and nobody wanted to put surpluses on the balance sheet because there was a big debate on whether they were the companies or the employees of the plan, and we had court cases around that and stuff. So depending on the environment, the topical nature of this changes. I don't think we're necessarily going to go back into high interest rates anytime soon, but you need to be aware of the impact of factors and what makes an accounting issue more or less pressing depending on what could happen in the environment.
Actuaries have carve-outs and carbine salsa.
They do then? Okay.
No, I'm just sorry.
There you go.
Just a follow-up in thinking about the comments that Sue and I were making about disclosure. I guess if I get to make a request of the working group or something, you know, to think about, I think maybe trying to develop, either identify some good practice examples in existing disclosure around plans that fall into this. You know, how do you take it, and rather than giving lots of data, give a description that identifies that you have a plan that doesn't fit well, and what's the key information about it? And depending upon how many good practice examples can be found, maybe thinking about, you know, you have examples of four hybrid plans here, what information might be useful information about all those in terms of giving somebody a starting point to say, could we look more like this in terms of effective communication and working with a couple of users who might tell you what information was most useful about these type of plans. Might be the, it's reminiscent of some of the work that we've done in Principles of Disclosure with the examples of publishing some good practice to try and encourage people to think about how to move things forward. So my first thought, thinking about the work you've done, is to say that maybe giving some examples of disclosure, not because disclosure fixes accounting, but if it's an area where there are lots of different interpretations, again, it might be helpful to see what that looks like.
Thank you for the suggestion. We'll take it back.
But the other thing to remember in the disclosure as well is it's not just about explaining the number you've put in the primary statements, but pensions are big and complex and difficult to understand and subject to lots of different risks. So whatever number you put in, it's not going to be enough by itself anyway.
Yeah, the recognized number doesn't.
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions?
Just to sort of report back on what the situation seems to be in AOSSG. So there's really only two countries, apart from Japan, who's already on the working group, that have indicated that they think they have any issues. So one is Korea. So there seems to be a type of a DC plan, but it's if you get a promotion, you get a guaranteed increase in past contributions up to the current promotion level. And then if you leave, you get the past contributions up to your final thing as well, which sort of seems a bit more like a DB, but not quite. But they've said that that's actually not an extensive amount of those types of things. And then the other one is India, where their private sector superannuation plans seem to have a benchmarking of the guaranteed return to what public sector schemes would get. So we're just sort of fleshing that out. That one's just come to light. I think we've got some really tiny ones in Australia, but not a lot, where there's some guarantees attached, but the rest of the countries that responded didn't have anything and certainly didn't have any significant levels of these issues. So the feedback really was a couple of countries supported actually moving ahead and doing something, but they weren't supportive of basically starting from scratch, and the rest of were neutral, saying you don't have a view one way or the other, but weren't sure that this was the most important project that the OSB should be doing at this stage.
Alexander?
Just to give you we have hybrid pension plans, and we have a pretty much over the region, and there is a kind of plan which is a defined contribution plan during the accumulation period, but when you retire, it becomes a defined benefit plan. So that's pretty much common. So it accumulates money, and then when it accumulates the money, then you sit down and make the calculation, and from now on, given that amount of money, you have a defined benefit. But the benefit just became defined once you retire.
So you annuitize when you get your balance.
You accumulate money, say you have $1 million. Well, basically, you have $1 million, your pension is going to be $7,000 a month. If you have more than that and less than that. Mm-hmm. The problem here is that there's some litigation at the moment because technically the company, after they start to have the liability after it is. But some people, at the end of the accumulation period, say, well, I should have more money, and you mismanage the plan. Yes. So the plan was poorly managed, and the employees have representatives, but the company has representatives on the board of the pension fund. And they say, well, you have responsibility. I should have more money. So they are pretty much putting the defined idea in the accumulation period when they should not have the defined elements, let me say. So there's a big issue at the moment in terms of how to make those two realities work. So defined contribution, then defined benefit.
Kimberly?
Just for completeness, say that we don't really have defined benefit plans in New Zealand, not common at all, particularly in the corporate sector, and to the extent that they do exist, they tend to be in the public sector. But even those are closed to new members, so they're sort of winding down. And where they have existed in the past, the move was basically straight to a defined contribution plan. So, as far as I know, I haven't done a survey, but as far as I know, I don't think we have hybrid plans, and if we do have any, that'd be quite fine.
Captain France.
We have no really hybrid plan, as far as I know. We have very few defined benefit plan in France, which are in the corporate sector, because it's an issue which is dealt at a legal level and on the public sector. So that and there is even fewer schemes that may be under IFRS finally. So we are not that concerned at this stage, but since French companies may have also subsidiaries everywhere in the world, so they are also concerned anyway. So I'm very interested in the project.
Alexander has been a bit...
I'm better.
Guys, you keep on confusing me.
He's better to... Okay. No, anyway, I think we are in a really similar condition of French colleagues. I mean, we're, as far as I know, there are not many situations of hybrid plans in companies' financial statements by companies applying IFRS. There may be cases... there are some cases of defined benefits plan, but there may be cases of entities investing in other countries. But as far our current investigation on this issue didn't really raise so much feedback from stakeholders, but we can continue to investigate maybe.
Any other comments? That brings us to the end of our meeting this month. Right? I wish you all a thank you for a good meeting, and I wish you all a very safe and good trip home.